You have come tonight to the most fabulous and celebrated place in the world. Here on the plateau of Gizeh stands forever the mightiest of human achievements. No traveler, emperor, merchant, or poet has trodden on these sands and not gasped in awe. The curtain of night is about to rise and disclose the stage on which the drama of a civilization took place. Those involved have been present since the dawn of history, pitched stubbornly against sand and wind. And the voice of the desert has crossed the centuries.
Hello, this is Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. Today's programme is about thinkers, but there is so much material that I've got relating to this subject that it seems a bit mean to just play a few little clips and tease you. So what I'm going to do is play a couple of quite long sides of records. There's one which is a speech by Buckminster Fuller, and another one which is a recording on the size and nature of the universe by Dr. Edward Teller, who we worked on rocketry as well as atomic physics. I think he worked at the Los Alamos laboratories. But I'm going to play a few other bits and pieces, and you'll hear during the Buckminster Fuller excerpt, you will hear the point of the son et lumière, minus the lumière, which you have to envisage for yourself from Cairo from the 1960s, which we'll get back to right now.
With each new dawn, I see the sun god rise on the far bank of the Nile. His first ray is for my face, which is turned towards him. And for 5,000 years, I have seen all the suns men can remember come up in the sky. I saw the history of Egypt in its first glow, as tomorrow I shall see the east burning with a new flame. I am the faithful warden at the foot of his Lord, so faithful, so vigilant, so near him that he gave me his face for my own. I am a Pharaoh's companion, and I am he, the Pharaoh. Through the ages, I received many names from the people who came to me in adoration.
O Harmachis, you are my life's safeguard.
Horus, protect me, O great God, that I might see you every day.
Lord of the desert, Lord of the heavens,
Sovereign of eternity.
But the name which has remained with me is that given to me by a Greek traveler, the father of history, Herodotus. He called me Sphinx, as if I were from his land. And that name is now mine. Close to the Nile, I watch over the plateau of Gizeh, over all its monuments of modest or fantastic height. They are tombs.
Civilizations are like islands on the ocean of barbarism. Over this one, the Sphinx has gazed and watched for 5,000 years. At the foot of such mountains of stone, everything becomes minute and insignificant. Man is an insect. And yet, it was men who built these massive monuments. And the names of pharaohs whose tombs they are have crossed the ages. Their glory has defeated time.
Tomb of Cheops. Pharaoh of the 4th dynasty, 4,500 years ago. Here is the great pyramid which he built to defend himself against death.
455 feet high. He achieved the building of the highest monument then known to man. The area it covers is vast enough to hold St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome, the cathedrals of Florence and Milan, Westminster Abbey and St. Paul's. 3 million blocks of stone, some of them weighing 30 tons, were assembled by Cheops' faithful workmen to achieve this fabulous construction. At the center of it, the pharaoh planned his inner chamber, where his mummy was to lie in splendor for eternity.
At the foot of this pyramid, in the rock, a temple was built. And there were kept the barges of Cheops, the barges of night. In these large wooden vessels, the dead pharaoh could continue his voyage in darkness towards eternity. But all that remains of him is a small ivory figure showing a noble face, the nose aquiline, the jaw determined, and the hieroglyphs representing the name he gave to his pyramid. Cheops dominates the horizon.
Well, from ancient Egypt, we're going to make a quick transition with the help of Edward Teller and a brief story set in Arabia. I'll let him tell you the rest.
The story is told that the Caliph Harun al-Rashid was one day seized by an unusual desire that is unusual even for a caliph. He had the desire to get some scientific information. So he called in the wisest man available, and he was very wise indeed, of course, and the caliph asked him, "I have heard that the earth is not quite flat, and I just cannot believe it." And the wise man said, "Commander of the faithful, few men know it, but the earth is indeed not flat. The earth is the back of a giant turtle with sleepy eyes." And the caliph, whose scientific interest has been now thoroughly aroused, asked, "But where is this turtle? Does he stand or does he swim?" The wise man said, "Commander of the faithful, this is a great secret, but the turtle swims in a big sea without a name." And the caliph thereupon asked the question, "But where is that sea?" And the wise man said, "The answer to that question only I know in the whole world, and I found it out myself. This sea is in a big ball carried on the back of a white elephant with golden tusks. But, Commander of the Faithful, on what the white elephant stands, nobody in the world knows."
And we'll come back to Edward Teller later on in the show to hear some of the more plausible ideas of the size and nature of the universe. Before that, we're going to move on to Buckminster Fuller, who is a very different character indeed. And if you can just get past his sort of hesitant delivery and get into the rhythm and the pattern of his speaking, then I guarantee you will enjoy listening to what he has to say and how he says it.
We're going to go back to our earliest written history. It takes us back about 8,000 years into Egypt. And at that time, the records make it fairly clear that life expectancy for human beings must have been about 19 years of age. There were, of course, many who did live beyond the expectancy, but that was the average. And those 19 years were filled with great want and pain. Life was so generally miserable that nobody could really conceive of this particular life as being worthwhile in its own right. The sort of general working assumption that life was a test which you would qualify, if possible, to get into the next life. And because life is so obviously ill-supported, there's so little to go around, and the pharaoh was the only one who really could see who could get on at all, it was the hope that if you would get the pharaoh into the next life, then he might be able to get his people along with him. So we have the, I'm sure at all ages there are always those individuals who are a little more ingenious, who would retain their childish initiatives and interests a little more than others. And I call that the Leonardo type, that they are trying to solve problems by design. And so I'm going to have a Leonardo type architect, engineer. And the pharaoh then asked him then to design some way of getting him over into the, safely into the next world with all the things he's going to need when he gets there. And then from that point, we hope that he's going to be able to bring his people over with him. So the general paucity of life support brought about a great deal of thievery, vandalism, and therefore the Leonardo type saw that he'd have to put whatever is going to be needed under a very extraordinary stone pile. And when you began to pile up stones, gravity, of course, held one stone on top of another. If you try to just pile them up vertically, it gets to a point where there's a tendency to tip the wrong way. So instead of letting them tip the wrong way, you just start with a very big base and then make a smaller covering on that and brings about the pyramid type. So the pyramid is just obviously not going to tip over. And so the pyramid form became very logical for an enormous stone pile under which you would, and within chambers inside of it, you would have all the things the pharaoh would need, where you could put the pharaoh himself in there and all the kind of tools, the implements and riches he would need when he got to the other side. So we have the first Leonardo type who realized they're going to have to move a great many stones, and he discovers the principle of the lever, and by virtue of it, he's able to move stones very extraordinarily. Nobody had ever seen that before, but that was part of his ingenuity and childish purity of seeing things, and which he had been born with but hadn't lost. We have finally the pharaoh dies, and they put him inside the tomb, and honor the architect for what he's done. They put him in there with the two so he can get over the other world a little faster. And now the pharaoh is gone, and of course when he's gone, there's another pharaoh. And so he has his Leonardo-type designer. And one of the things that happens is that the second pharaoh and his Leonardo now have inherited the lever that's being used. In other words, that in principle didn't go into the tomb when the architect went in there. Everybody had been using it, so they said it's logical to use it. So it was what I might call scaffolding in this world to get you into the next world. Now, we have this second architect, see the great many people are dying of starvation. All of his workers are dying of starvation, and he sees that the Nile River, wherever it touches the ground along its banks, is green. But you've got to get a little distance away and goes in the desert and all, everything is brown. And so he invents having irrigation, having ditches come in from the Nile, deeply in the land, bringing water, and finds that the amount of green increases very rapidly, so it builds up the amount of food you can grow. So he's invented the irrigation system as a help in keeping his men alive to get that work done. His pharaoh dies, and they put him in the tomb with the pharaoh, and now comes pharaoh number three. And so one by one, various very ingenious concepts are manifest by these Leonardos, who design them into the task in this world in order to get you over in the next world. But they always leave the new tools in this world for the next situation. So there's a very rapid accumulation of tools and concepts of the building. And the tools for chipping of the stone or whatever it may be to make it fit a little better. And ingenious ways of learning how to carry the stone down the Nile River and so forth, and how to get it over in place. We have the next Leonardo invents the idea of continually bringing up sand. It's very easy with thousands of men to keep pushing sand up to high on your pyramid, so you can keep sliding the rocks of stone with levers up on the hillside. So in other words, you keep burying it in a hill that is easy to negotiate. So this way they get the stones up there. And after it's all over, they can either take that away or just leave it. And often we find that is true. The pyramid goes way, way down deep in the ground beyond the covering soil and earth. Now, we get to the point where so much has been acquired in technology in the scaffolding in this world that we get to a point when suddenly it seems evident to all those in power that not only could they take care of the next pharaoh, but they could also take care of all the nobles. So they enlarge the programs, and the nobles have their Leonardos doing their designing, and there's a very swift multiplication of tools in the new scaffolding idea, plus the earlier principles that have been discovered. We finally get to the point where we get taking care of the rich middle class. And this brings you to the time of the Greeks and the Romans, when you have the individual powerful families having their own mausoleums. Finally, there's so much development of technological capability, and comes a time when first a Buddha, then a Christ, and then a Muhammad say, we have the capability now really to get everybody in the next world. And this is a very extraordinary moment. All human beings are preparing temples, churches, cathedrals, mosques, to prepare all these people to get in the next world. They must have a whole lot of instruction. So the enormous amount of building of the mosques and the cathedrals and the temples. And finally, there's so much technology, and the potential of what you can do with the knowledge we have is so high that it said, you know, we not only could take care of getting everybody into the afterlife, but we also have enough capability to take care of the king in this life. So that brought about the moment we call the divine right of kings. So there was not only, he didn't really have to wait until he got into the next world before he began to do quite a lot for him. Still further multiplication then of the capability, because this is a multiplicative regenerativity of tools, beginning concepts of tools, so that the Leonardo type tends to think in those tools. So it finally has so much know-how, so many tools. It said, not only can we take care of getting everybody in the afterlife, but we can also take care of the king in this life and also the nobles. That's the Magna Carta time. Tools keep on multiplying even more. Finally we get to say we take care of the afterlife of everybody and the life of the king and the nobles. Now we can also take care of the rich middle class. That brings you to what we call the Victorian period, very, very recent in our history. In fact, I was born just at the tail end of the Victorian period in 1895. Then we came into this 20th century, and there was so much tool proliferation, there was such an environmental stimulation of awareness of tools, that we have a Henry Ford. We have a Henry Ford really getting the point where he said, we now have the capability not only to get everybody in the afterlife, but we can take care of everybody in this life too. This brings about a really very different kind of idea. And that is now, for instance, in my own life, I found myself tremendously inspired by the realization that of what was going on in our technology. As, for instance, the fact that we were, in my birth time, looking upon phenomena where we said, reality is everything you can see, smell, touch, and hear. When I was 3, the electrons discovered. The year I was born, X-rays discovered. But they didn't make the newspapers. Nobody knew those were going to be anything. We get into a new world then of that electronics. We get into the new world of discovering the radio and all the different lengths of frequencies, of wavelengths of our electromagnetic waves. We begin to gradually discover early in the century that each of the chemical elements, when incandescent in the arc flame, give off light, which light, if it's led through a prism, is then broken down into spectrum bands, and the spectrograph camera can photograph, and the chemical emulsion of photography can see frequencies that your eye and my eye cannot see, so they make black bands. And we found that every chemical element had its own unique set of frequencies, so that once you knew that, and no other chemical element has those frequencies, you're able to identify when just taking light, let's say, from a distant star. You can tell how many chemical elements are in that star just by identifying those light bands. And then this brought about what might call the total electromagnetic spectrum. 1930, for the first time in history, we have a publishing of the great electromagnetic spectrum by the Westinghouse Company. There had been all kinds of individual scientists keeping track of this set of events and that set of events, but this is the first comprehensive, where it started with the mile-long radio waves of World War I, which got shorter and shorter. We learned how to use shorter wavelengths and so forth. And we gradually get, and all these things are invisible, and we go through many of the chemical elements, then we suddenly come to infrared, and then red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, where you and I can tune in. Then we go into ultraviolet and out, and on it goes. And as of 1930, it was manifest to us that what is reality, because all these chemical elements were reality. The fact that our eye were not tuned to see those frequencies, for us not to be able to see what's going on in the radio waves with our eyes. Then we thought that, really in the old way of looking at things, it wasn't real if you couldn't see it. But I'm saying now, we suddenly discovered in 1930 that 99.9% of reality was no longer directly contactable, apprehendable by the human senses. This is a very, very big jump. And I find society hasn't thought about that, and society carries on exactly as if that were not true, and the newspapers still deal in the just see it, smell it, touch it, and hear it. So I find a reality, we're carrying on in a shrunken little bit of reality in relation to a very extraordinary new aspect of universe, which is available to us, but it's invisible, therefore you can only tend to feel that you can deal with it through some kind of scientific training and some kind of capability to deal with instruments. Then maybe you can penetrate into that invisible world. But I point out today we have any place you might be around the world, if you had 2 million wideband radio sets with you, you could tune each one in on a different program. For any place around the world today, there are more than 2 million programs that are in the air, but not tuned in, therefore absolutely invisible and silent to you and I. But if you tune in on them, you could tune all of those 2 million sets in each in a different program. They're all there. There are programs that are right in this room, then 2 million programs right here. 2 million programs going through your head right now. So if you had the right equipment in your head, you could pick up any one of them if you want to tune in on them. I find this gives me a very different kind of feeling about life. The feeling I get is the following. I find that humanity using the words up and down, which have no real meaning. Up and down were invented to accommodate the misconception that our world was a flat plane going to infinity. A flat plane to infinity, all the perpendiculars to it are parallel to one another. So all the trees and all the other people all perpendicularly said to the same plane, and therefore there are only two directions up and down. The minute you realize you're on a sphere, none of the radii of the sphere, all of which are perpendicular to the sphere, are parallel to one another. And all of us today know that we've got all of us have friends all around the world today, and we know that they're not upside down. That the words upside down have absolutely no meaning. There is no up in the universe, there's no direction called up. Our Earth is continually revolving. So you say, what star are you pointing to when you said that was up? Because pretty soon, only 12 hours from now, it's going to be in the direction of your feet. So that there's no up and down in the universe. So he said, what are the right words to use? And the aviators learned to say long ago, you come in for a landing and you go out instead of up and down. So in and out and around are the right words of direction. And in, you can point, in is always pointable. You can point, you can go into the moon or into the earth or into Mars. Out is any direction. You can go in through the earth, go out on the other side. Out is any direction. Very interesting, in and out are not opposite kind of things. One is very specific, the other is absolutely broadcast. So I find that we begin to use the words in and out instead of up and down. Then we get into the language of electromagnetics, because you tune in and you tune out. This begins to get you in another way of looking at things, because in the old world of up and down, you had things and you had space. When I get into the electromagnetic world, there's no such thing as space. I simply have what I have tuned in now, and that's what we're conscious of, and I can tune it out and bring it back in again. In other words, you begin to get quite a different idea of phenomena, what life and death may be. Whether it's really something to do with tunings and not to do with ups and downs and in and out. It is to do with tuning in and tuning out. But when you tune out, doesn't mean it's dead. I want to understand that. I think that I'm coming back to my series of Leonardo types. Because we got then to where Henry Ford said, enough for everybody in this life. Then began to think about the increase of capabilities that came with alloys and electronics, where you continually did more with less. Nothing could be more impressive just in the computer world, of the great big computers in smaller and then smaller and smaller and smaller, getting down where you can have it in a ring and so forth. There's capability to do more with less. Begin to make it very clear that you can take care of everybody, not only take care of them, but take care of them ever and ever higher standard of living. Now it's beginning to be really very evident. We can take care of all the generations to come.
And one of this the things is Voice on Record on Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com, and that was the voice of Buckminster Fuller, recorded in 1979. We're talking about, I'm not talking about anybody really, I'm just trying to play some records, and the next one is from a BBC dialect record.
Well, I was given away at 3 days old. I was a twin. My grandfather and grandmother brought me up. They had 7 men work for them, the carpenters and wheelwrights. I was always on my own, and my grandfather told me, always go out on your own, and never let your left hand know what your right hand do. I could have been a carpenter. I might have had my grandfather's carpenter shops and that left to me. They were left to me. I'd had him, they'd still have been a Brooks carpenter and we'd right at Bolton. That was there 250, yeah, and I might have been there now. But the only thing is, I just didn't like the idea of being shot in. If I go out in the morning, I get home when I like, and I have my dinner when I like. That's awesome food in the pantry, and I know there's some there, and I look after myself. I never worry about looking at a watch, because a man who looked at a watch and got to leave off at a certain time and bond time and that, he have his ideas. But in a factory, I can't see whether they're any better off than I am.
There's a little antidote for some of the heavy stuff that we've been going through so far in the programme, and that's a little something there from Norfolk, especially for Hannah, Jessica and Charlotte. Now, I think we're going to go back to Edward Teller to really tell us what he thinks about the size and nature of the universe as mediated through a record made by Spoken Arts and the Convair Division of General Dynamics Corporation. Who are proud to boast the Atlas Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, amongst other sorts of technologies they've been developing.
Well, our knowledge today about the world is a little bit different from the knowledge of that wise man. We know, of course, and you all know, that the world is not flat and that it is, that is, our Earth is, completely round. We know that it is sort of a big object, even though these days one can travel around it without too much difficulty. How big it is, I want to tell you, just for one reason, because I would like to help you get a measure of how big other things are. And in a strange way, this measure is obtained by thinking about a thing that travels very, very fast indeed. And that thing is light. Light travels so fast that if it could be made to travel on a curved path, it would travel around the Earth 7.5 times in 1 second. Now, this will help us to understand how big the rest of the universe is. The closest object outside the Earth, the object to which we shall first get when all of us space travelers really get going, is of course the Moon. And that is approximately so far away that light takes 1 second to get from the Moon to us, or, of course, from us to the Moon. Nevertheless, when you travel to the Moon yourself, you will have to take a little longer time than this 1 second, although it might not be, when we learn how to do it, much longer than the time will take to go from New York to Los Angeles. Then, beyond the Moon, of course, the next really big object is the Sun. That is far enough away so that light takes approximately 8 minutes to get from the Sun to the Earth. This is a distance which we call, therefore, 8 light minutes. Now, I cannot go on and talk about other things before I have told you a few things about the Sun, some of which you may know already. One thing is that all the heat, all the light, or most of it anyway, that we get here on Earth, comes from the Sun. But if we may follow the example of Harun al-Rashid and be a bit too inquisitive, we might ask, from where does the Sun take its energy? How does it make all this heat and light? Now that, fortunately, we can tell you, and very many of us know it now, and it has been found out quite a few years ago. The Sun takes its energy from, now I have to use a long word, but one which is already a bit familiar and is going to get more and more familiar, of course. The Sun makes its energy from thermonuclear reactions. And I should like to tell you in a very few words what this means. When we get heat out of a fireplace, what happens in the fireplace? That the smallest parts into which matter can be divided, the atoms, get into new combinations with each other, and while they get into these new combinations, they acquire a lot of energy, a lot of agitation, and that agitation is what we call heat. But the atoms are not really the smallest things. At the center of the atoms are other objects called the nuclei, which are very, very much smaller still than the atoms, and which contain all the mass, or almost all the mass of the atoms, which are nothing like atoms. Now, such nuclei almost never get together and react with each other, but if they do, and they do it at the high temperatures inside the sun, then they release a very great amount of energy, and that is what keeps the sun going and what keeps all the stars going, because you know that the stars are similar things like the sun itself. Of course, I was carried away and I started to talk now about small things rather than about what I should be talking here, namely about big things. And so let's go and see what's farther outside. Around the sun, there are a number of planets moving. One of them is the Earth. It is one of the smaller and closer planets in the outer, distant, frozen places. Very uninviting for space travelers, of course. There are much bigger objects like Jupiter and Saturn, and then dimmer little objects, but still bigger, much bigger than the Earth. And light will travel many hours to get from the sun to these. And what comes outside these? Well, outside of this planetary system, there comes nothing. And after that nothing, there comes more nothing. And after that nothing, there comes lots more of the nothing that we call space. Now, the space is not quite empty. You will find in it approximately one of the smallest atoms, a hydrogen atom, in a space which we call a cubic centimeter, which is just a little bit smaller than a cubic inch. In a cubic inch, you might find, well, maybe 20 hydrogen atoms. But otherwise, you have nothing at all except great emptiness. A little bit more than 100 years ago, astronomers succeeded to find at the end of the emptiness a star at a definite distance. Before that, of course, we have seen the stars, but we did not have any idea at all how far each of these stars should be. And it is remarkable how recent the time is when for the first time it was possible to say definitely, this is how far away a definite star will be. Well, I can tell you that the nearest star is so far away that light takes approximately 3 years to travel from that star to us. And here you will see a little bit of a difficulty in the way of people who want to explore space. Because in our own solar system, it may well turn out that the only comfortable planet is the Earth. Now, outside our solar system, there are many, many stars. And nobody has seen planets around these stars, but I'm quite confident that many of these distant stars do have planets. But it might take a little time to get to these distant objects, because even light takes 3 years to get to the closest one of them. Now, of these stars, you know, there are very many. With your naked eye, you can see, I think, under the best conditions, a couple of thousand. But with a good telescope, you can see many, many, many more. And you can observe a weak, whitish band in the sky, the Milky Way. And you know, of course, very well that this Milky Way is composed itself of countless stars, more stars than even the best telescope can distinguish from each other. Nevertheless, we are beginning to get an idea how this Milky Way looks as a whole. And we get an idea because we know that similar objects exist outside the Milky Way system. These are called the spiral nebulae. But I won't talk about them for the moment. I will merely talk about the Milky Way system.
Hello, if you've just tuned in, you have been listening to Dr. Edward Teller telling you about the size and nature of the universe. This is Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams. You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. We're going to go back to Edward Teller in a second, but if you've got any queries or questions or you want to make any comments, don't hesitate to email me at voiceonrecord@gmail.com. That's voiceonrecord@gmail.com. And now back to Edward Teller talking about the Milky Way.
It consists of billions of stars, such as the Sun. And these billions of stars are spread out over a giant disk. I shouldn't say over, throughout a giant disk. The thickness of this disk is a few thousand light years. That is, for light to cross the thin direction of the disk will take about a length of time like 2,000 years, a little longer maybe. But for light to go from end to end of the disk takes a lot longer, maybe 40,000 light years, although the outer ends are not very clearly defined, because as you go farther and farther out, you are going to find fewer and fewer stars, and you cannot very easily say these are the city limits. These stars are by no means uniformly distributed throughout the Milky Way. Rather, there are lots more near the center of it. At the center, you have an assembly of very closely packed stars. They are still far from each other, but they are much closer to each other than stars in our neighborhood. If we could see this center of the Milky Way system, it would appear to our eyes as an object one-tenth as bright as the full moon. However, we can't see it because it is covered up by a dark cloud of fine dust. Dust particles which one finds out in these spaces and which are very far from each other, the individual dust particles. Yet, the whole dust cloud is deep enough that in the end, you do not succeed in seeing through it. In a way, you do succeed in seeing through it, however. Because from all over the place, and in particular from the center of the Milky Way system, there come noises. The stars do not make only light. They send out all kinds of other signals. In particular, they send out radio signals. We get such radio signals from individual stars at considerable distances. But we get more radio signals from the center of the Milky Way system than we get from anywhere else. And these radio signals confirm an old suspicion which we had now for many years, that in a certain apparently dark direction, there actually must be very many stars, and that is the direction in which the center of the Milky Way system is found. Now I would like to talk to you a little bit more about the interior of our Milky Way system, about a few individual stars. Just without any particular reason, but some of these stars are really spectacular. Some of them are big, tenuous gas masses. in which the material is no denser than in what an experimental physicist will call a moderately good vacuum. In some other stars, the density, these stars are called the white dwarfs, in these the density is so great that I could not hold up in my hand the weight of 1 cubic inch of this material. Very much less than that even. One finds in these stars densities 100 times surpassing the densest materials here available on Earth. But these are just ordinary atoms pressed together peculiarly strongly. There are some stars which pulsate and some stars which explode. The exploding stars are called new stars, or novae. Some of them are particularly violent exploders. They are called, of course, the supernovae. They do not occur very frequently, once every few 100 years, but we see such very big explosions elsewhere in the universe, and about that I will talk in a very short time. Right in our system, such an explosion, we know from the Chinese annals, has occurred a little bit more than 900 years ago. At the place of that explosion, we now see a faint star, a diffuse system called the Crab Nebula, and also a lot of radio noise, these agitated masses which stream out from the original position of the supernova are still sending out radio signals. Incidentally, we know a very great deal about this Chinese supernova for a very simple reason. A short time before the supernova exploded, there was an eclipse. And this eclipse was not predicted by the Chinese astronomers. And two of these Chinese astronomers, the two chief ones, lost their heads for not predicting the eclipse. Therefore, when the supernova appeared, the head of the chief astronomer felt a little funny. And not having predicted it, and being fortunate enough to keep a somewhat shaky head on his shoulders, he very carefully recorded from day to day the appearance of the supernova. And now, due to the duress under which this poor Chinese astronomer found himself, we have very complete records of the supernova which has originally given rise to the Crab Nebula and its radio noise. But I have promised to tell you what is outside the Milky Way system. And outside the Milky Way system is really nothing. Not even an atom in a cubic inch. And quite probably not even an atom in a cubic foot. And how much less than that, I cannot possibly tell you. I do not know. And at the end of that nothingness, there is again something else. And that something else is a little farther away than 1,000,000 light years. Light takes 1,000,000 years to come from that distant place to us. And that distant place is called the Andromeda Nebula. It is a big thing, at least it is big in reality. To our eyes, it just seems like a tiny speck. But in a telescope, it looks like a beautiful spiral. This whitish mass is a collection of stars, of which we can see only the very brightest. And then, if there is a supernova in Andromeda that explodes with such brilliance that this individual explosion we can see. The Andromeda Nebula is not the only one of these objects. Far from it. There are many, many other such nebulae. Some loose spirals, some tighter spirals, some ellipsoids or spheres, all of them containing enormous number of individual stars. And as far as our most powerful telescopes can carry, there are more and more of these objects. And up to a distance of a billion light years, we still see these objects. And beyond these, our biggest telescopes at present do not carry. Imagine the most distant of these objects that we can see has sent out the light which we now observe a billion years ago at a time when quite possibly there has been no living being on Earth, although Earth at that time surely existed. Now you may ask, what is beyond this limit? And how big is the universe altogether? We do not know, but we have some indications. First of all these spiral nebulae behave in such a way as though they had been shot out from some place at a given time. You see, if such an explosion, such an incredibly big explosion, would ever have occurred, then the nebulae flying out from there with uniform speed would distribute themselves in such a way that the ones which have moved fastest would be now farthest away. And that is just what we see. The farther a nebula is from us, the faster it moves away, as though all would have come from one neighborhood a long time ago. And you can calculate that this long time was just about 5 billion years ago. And when you look back in the geologic records, in the most ancient geologic records of the Earth, we find that the Earth itself has an age of perhaps 5 billion years. So, perhaps, indeed, there was something like an origin, like a creation, about 5 billion years ago. And perhaps the making of the Earth did not come at a very late stage of this creation. But whether that really was the beginning, or whether there is something on which the white elephant with the golden tusks stands, that nobody knows.
Well, 5 billion or 15 billion, what's 10 billion years amongst friends? Anyway, that was Edward Teller some time ago. Unfortunately, there's no date on the record, but we could possibly find out. And if I do, I shall let you know via the website, which is sbkw.net/voice-on-record. Now, I've got a little short excerpt of Jeji Krishnamurti. It's a very long speech, actually. It goes over two sides of a record, and it's entitled Action Without Conflict. I haven't got time to play you much, but I'd like to just give you a flavour. And one of my favourite things about this recording is the context. It's recorded in India, and there are so many sonic archaeological details in there, from the crows and the PA system sort of verging on feedback and traffic. It's such a rich recording, and I love it. So here's a short section.
I think the more one observes the world's condition, the more it becomes clear that there must be a totally different kind of action. One sees in the world, including in India, the confusion, the great sorrow, the misery, the starvation, the general decline. One is aware of this. One knows it from newspapers, reading magazines, books. But it remains on the intellectual level. Because we don't seem to be able to do anything about it. Human beings are in despair. There's great sorrow in themselves, frustration. And there's chaos about one. The more you observe and go into it, not intellectually, not verbally, but actually discuss, observe, act, inquire, examine, the more you see how confused human beings are. They're lost. And those who think they are not lost because they belong to a particular group, a circle, and feel the more you practice, the more you do certain things, the more you do social work or this or that, the more they are sure that the world is going to be saved, their particular little action. The world is at war. And you think by particular prayer, few of us people gathered together repeating certain words will solve this enormous question which has remained unsolved for over 5,000 years by words, prayer. And you keep on repeating, though knowing that wars can never be stopped that way. So each one belongs to a certain group, to a certain political party, to a religious sect, and so on, and remains in it. More and more holding on to the past, to what has been. And one is caught in this. One admits when it is pointed out that there is chaos, general decline, deterioration, outwardly and inwardly. And one realizes man is lost. And without finding out why he is lost, why there is so much chaos, misery, without examining, going into it very deeply, we answer superficially, saying that we're not following God, or that man we don't love, give superficial, platitudinous answers that have no value at all. And during these talks, if one has listened to them at all, one must have come to the question, why? Why this mess? Why this confusion?
Unfortunately, that's where we're going to have to leave Krishnamurti. You've been listening to Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams. Get in touch via email at voiceonrecord@gmail.com, and I'll leave you with a quick burst of a very different thinker indeed. Until next week, goodbye.
Medium is the massage. The medium is the massage. Marshmallow, marshmallow.
Yeah, how about that?
There'll probably be some music, but we'll manage to find a quiet corner where we can talk.
Professor McLuhan is...
Our time is a time for crossing barriers, for erasing old categories, for probing around. When two seemingly disparate elements are imaginatively posed, put in apposition in new and unique ways, startling discoveries often result.